I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing recently that's hopefully about to appear on marginal deformations of n=4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. I'll also touch on some earlier work with Tim Hollowood and Prem Kumar, who are also at Swansea. So in the last few years, we've learned a lot about supersymmetric gauge theories, but the one that we most understand the best, and the one that seems to exhibit the most miraculous properties, is the one, as you'd expect, with the most supersymmetry, in fact, the most possible rigid supersymmetry in four dimensions, which is n=4 supersymmetry. I'll be generically talking about the n=4 theory with gauge group UN or SUN, and sometimes thinking about n being large. And just a notational point, as usual, you write the gauge coupling and vacuum angle of the n=4 theory as a single complex parameter in this way. So among the properties that have emerged, some are older than others. The oldest one, still remarkable, is the fact that the theory has an exactly vanishing beta function, so that the gauge coupling, in fact, this complex coupling tau, is an exactly marginal parameter. More recently, evidence has gradually accumulated that an old conjecture, which dates back to work by David Olive and Klaus Montanen, that there should be some form of duality between electric and magnetic charges in the theory, the evidence has accumulated that that's actually an exact property of the theory. Various special quantities that you can calculate exactly, for example, have this property. And in fact, it's larger than just a duality between an electric and magnetic charges. It's actually a whole modular group of duality transformations that act on this complex parameter tau. Most recently, of course, and perhaps the most striking breakthrough is due to Maldacena's ideas about the large n Toft limit of the n=4 theory. Of course, it had been suspected for a very long time that there should be a dual string theory formulation, but now we think we know what it is, and it's 2B string theory on ADS5 cross S5 background. So those are three properties that are now fairly well established, and they make the n=4 theory really quite something quite remarkable in that it has some exact manifestations of things like electromagnetic duality and the large n duality to a string theory, things that we'd like to be able to apply. They're old ideas that go back to the 70s that we'd like to be able to apply to more interesting field theories. However, the n=4 theory is, of course, a long way away from being the real world. Its phase structure is very simple. In particular, if you set the vacuum expectation values of the scalars equal to zero, you get an exactly conformally invariant theory, which is interesting formally, but has little direct relevance to the kind of field theories that enter in the standard model. The other possibility is to set the verbs to be non-zero, in which case you get a typical pattern of breaking down to a product of U1s, and the theory is in a Coulomb phase with long-range electric and magnetic fields. But what can we learn about more interesting, realistic quantum field theories? In particular, of course, one thing that we always want to know about is the confining phase that ordinary Yang-Mills theory exhibits. Well, one way you can try and make top-down progress towards understanding how these things might generalize to more interesting field theories is to do something that's quite natural if you think about the n=4 theory as a conformal field theory. A natural, as the basic objects in the theory are operators of definite scaling dimension, the natural operation you can do to that, that's of course been studied widely in two dimensions, is to add those operators to the Lagrangian of the theory. And in general, we expect different behavior depending on what the dimension of those operators is. So in fact, a lot of work has been done in the past on relevant deformations of n=4 Suzy Yang-Mills, and in fact, that's something I've worked a lot on myself in the past. And that actually has a very interesting story, which I won't talk about too much today, where in fact, as you'd expect, if you add a relevant operator, you flow in the infrared to a different theory, and in fact, you can flow it to a massive theory. And in fact, the phases that are realized when you basically introduce a relevant deformation, one that preserves n=1 supersymmetry, includes all the massive phases we're interested in, like the Higgs and confining phase. And there's a rather nice extension of S-duality that acts on these vacua, which I'll touch on a bit later. But what I want to talk about today is much less studied, what happens if you marginally deform the n equals 4 theory, and in particular add a marginal operator. Now, in general, of course, the idea is that adding a marginal operator to a conformal field theory takes you to another conformal field theory, and this is something that's much studied. So that's in terms of getting towards the real world, maybe that doesn't bias very much. But in fact, what I'll show is that this conformal field theory has some very interesting vacuum states in which the conformal symmetry is spontaneously broken, and so it can give us some rather interesting results. So what is the theory that I'm talking about? Well, I'm going to start from the n equals 4 theory in n equals 1 supermultiplet language. So in the language of n equals 1 superfields, as you'd find in the book by Wess and Bagge, the model contains a vector multiplet and three adjoint chiral multiplets, which I've denoted phi I, where I runs from 1 to 3. The n equals 4 theory has a superpotential at the classical level, which consists of a commutator term. And the deformation I'm going to think about doing is basically taking that commutator and deforming it so that it's no longer a pure commutator. And the particular deformation that I'm going to think about is maybe something that people who work on quantum groups will recognize, where you take a commutator and basically you deform it so that at a certain finite value of the deformation it would become an anti-commutator. So I'm also going to include a constant k in front of overall normalization in front of the superpotential relative to the other terms in the Lagrangian, and you recover the n equals 4 theory by setting the parameter beta equal to 0 and the parameter kappa goes to being 1. So first of all, of course, it's a very, very strong statement to say that this is actually a marginal deformation of the n equals 4 theory. Of course, if you want a marginal deformation in four dimensions, you've got to add to the Lagrangian an operator whose scaling dimension is exactly equal to 4. That corresponds to adding an operator to the superpotential whose scaling dimension is exactly equal to 3. That's how the business of superspace works out. So basically, you have to be able to identify operators in the theory and know that their exact scaling dimensions are their classical ones and that they don't get anomalous dimensions. Well, at least to linear order in the deformation, that's rather straightforward because to linear order in the deformation, we can just think about the conformal dimensions of the operators as being the dimensions they take in the n equals 4 theory, and that's constrained by the n equals 4 superconformal algebra. And in particular, there's a very special class of operators called chiral primary operators, of which one of the things appearing in the deformation is exactly a chiral primary operator, which I called O2. This formula here just illustrates, if you go to first order in the deformation parameter, what the change in the superpotential is. So the chiral primary is actually the second operator, which involves the anticommutator. Whereas the first operator, which involves a commutator, isn't actually a chiral primary. It's a kind of descendant state. So in fact, there are exact non-renormalization theorems in the n equals 4 theory that protect chiral primaries from receiving anomalous dimensions. That's an exact statement that you can make based on the superconformal ward identities. And actually, we understand that in the modern language of the ADS-CFT correspondence rather well, because we believe that the chiral primary states, chiral primary operators in the n equals 4 theory, correspond to supergravity fields in anti-de Sitter space, whose masses, they're effectively massless in anti-de Sitter space, and their masses are related to the scaling dimension, and we know that they stay massless, so the scaling dimension of the corresponding operator had better stay equal to 3, in this case, for a superpotential deformation. On the other hand, the remaining operators in the n equals 4 theory that don't get mapped to the low-energy supergravity fields in anti-de Sitter space get mapped to stringy modes. The masses of those modes correspond to the dimensions of the operators. And using the correspondence between the parameters of the n equals 4 theory and of the ADS, its ADS dual, you can argue that in the limit where the Toft couplings becomes large, which is basically the supergravity limit, all the stringy modes, of course, get large masses if you take a supergravity limit, taking the string length scale to 0, and that corresponds to taking the Toft coupling to infinity. And these other operators, we believe, will receive large anomalous dimensions in that limit, so they will not be exactly marginal. So at zeroth order in the perturbation, there is actually one exactly marginal direction that I've listed here, and another operator which I've included for reasons that I'll tell you in a moment. Now, to work beyond linear order and show that these directions persist as marginal directions is much, much harder. In particular, you can only use the constraints of n equals 1 supersymmetry, which we're preserving here. And of course, you've completely lost any information based on n equals 4 supersymmetry. Nevertheless, it is possible to show that one marginal parameter deformation persists. Specifically, what Lee and Strassler did quite some time ago was to study the exact beta functions, which are still constrained by n equals 1 supersymmetry, and they're also constrained by the symmetry between the three chiral superfields. And what they showed is that whereas generically, if you try and solve the beta functions for three couplings, you get three equations, and so isolated solutions, what they managed to show is that in this case, in this supersymmetric case, they showed that two of the equations are redundant, so that you actually expect a two-parameter surface of solutions. And that's an exact statement. And having already found our two parameters in the vicinity of the n equals 4 point, one parameter being this new marginal coupling beta I've introduced, and the other parameter being the gauge coupling of the n equals 4 theory, we can believe that it extends to a finite family of extends to finite values of the deformation parameters, and we really have a critical surface of conformal field theories. And you could describe that, in fact, if you go beyond leading order, it involves a mixture of these two operators, and you can describe it by saying that you have to choose a special value of this parameter kappa for every value of the gauge coupling and of beta. So we have two exactly marginal couplings. Sorry? The operator? The operator, these operators break n equals 4 down to n equals 1 supersymmetry. They break the R symmetry of the n equals 4 theory down to an abelian subgroup. And that's essentially all the global symmetry that the n equals 4 theory has. So of course, having a marginal deformation, one thing we'd like to understand is, if we move in these marginal directions, do some of the miraculous properties of the n equals 4 theory survive? And in particular, does this property of electromagnetic invariance, duality invariance, which we've now got strong evidence for, does that survive? Well, once again, you can make some reasonable sounding arguments at the linear order in the deformation, where you're just deforming the operator, the superpotential, by adding this chiral primary at first order in the deformation. You're just changing beta, adding this chiral primary operator to the superpotential. Well, in fact, you can argue convincingly that this operation will preserve S-duality in a certain sense, because at the n equals 4 point, we understand exactly what the properties of the chiral primaries are under the electromagnetic duality transformation. Chiral primaries get mapped to supergravity fields, and in the supergravity limit, SL2Z gets extended to SL2R, and the supergravity fields have well-known transformation properties under that SL2R, and in fact, you can use the ADS-CFT correspondence in that way to deduce what the transformation properties of the chiral primary operators are under electromagnetic duality. And the answer is rather nice. They transform as modular forms, as SL2Z is the modular group, they transform as modular forms of definite weight. And their weight is effectively fixed by their scaling dimension, which, as I've said, is a definite number that's fixed at the classical value. So rather like how you would think with a broken symmetry, although this operator is not invariant under the action of the modular group, when you add it onto the Lagrangian, and in fact you should be thinking of this all inside expectation values in a particular vacuum, you know how basically the operator is going to transform. It's not invariant, but in fact you could restore the invariance by assigning the appropriate coupling constant, which in this case is beta, with the appropriate modular weight. So in fact you can restore the SL2Z invariance in the same way you would formally restore a broken symmetry, simply by saying, well, I have to have my SL2Z acting in a particular way on the deformation parameter also. And in fact, you have to assign it weight minus 1 so that it transforms in this way. Now, trying to go beyond linear order is very difficult, and it's actually a problem I thought about a few years ago and completely failed to come up with anything. But fortunately, there's been a major set of developments in the last year which allow us to investigate, at least just with n equals 1 supersymmetry, a certain class of quantities in n equals 1 theories that we can evaluate exactly. And there is now an algorithm, more or less, for any n equals 1 theory, more or less, to evaluate what's called the effective superpotential exactly. So the effective superpotential is basically, in an n equals 1 theory, that's the thing that controls the potential, which controls which vacua you have and what are the expectation values of the chiral fields in those vacua. So this is a rather long story, which I want to breeze through very, very quickly, because I really want to just use the result of this story. This is older work by myself with Tim and Prem Kumar from last year, in which we looked at a further relevant deformation of this new conformal field theory, where again it flows in the infrared to a massive phases, different vacua, which live in the Higgs confining and oblique confining phases. So how do we know that's the case? Well, we know that's the case because we can actually calculate explicitly what the effective superpotential induced by including these relevant deformations is. That's quite a long story, but the technology has been developed recently that actually manages to relate the holomorphic sector of n equals 1 theories, in other words, the properties that depend only holomorphically on the constants, the coupling constants and the fields, relate them to something that is exactly solvable. They're related to a definite matrix model that you associate, you build out of the classical superpotential. And by solving that matrix model in the planar limit, you can actually extract what the effective superpotential is. This is work introduced about a year ago by Digraph and Vaffa, where they've actually been very successful in providing an algorithm by which you can calculate holomorphic quantities in supersymmetric field theories exactly. And very, very roughly speaking, the idea is that these quantities depend holomorphically on certain coupling constants, but they're actually independent of a bunch of other coupling constants. They have special stability properties reminiscent of the Witten index, and so you can deform the theory to a region in which you can calculate things safely. Now, that's a story which I'm not going to go into any depth, but basically what we did was take the Digraph-Vaffa procedure and use it to calculate the exact superpotential for this relevant deformation of my new marginally deformed superconformal field theory. And we found results which generalized the earlier results from the relevant deformations of n equals 4, that in fact you flow in the infrared to a variety of different vacua realized in different phases, and you can calculate the exact value of the superpotential and therefore also of the condensates of various chiral operators like the Gluino condensate in those vacua. And the result, which I'll just flash onto the transparency because this is going to be a talk mainly about the applications of the result rather than the result itself, is you discover miraculously that this effective superpotential in all these different vacua, and I really don't want to go through this in too much detail except to say that the answer from solving this matrix model is indeed a modular form and has modular properties under tau from which you can extract the fact that there is an SL2Z duality symmetry acting on the chiral fields of this relevant deformation. And in fact, the transformation is a direct generalization of the transformation that you meet in the n equals 4 theory. So this is actually the transformation that our results for these effective superpotential is invariant under. It's basically a small tweak of the n equals 4 S duality, in which the coupling constant is replaced by a slightly algebraically renormalized coupling constant, which also involves this deformation parameter kappa, which I introduced previously. And you get SL2Z acting on that slightly modified coupling constant. And out of it comes the expected weight for the deformation parameter beta. And you also find what the relevant transformation property for the other parameter, in fact, in the combination kappa squared sine beta is. So the upshot which I just want to present as a result rather than as the main content of this talk, that doesn't help, does it? Is that is that we can extend this linear analysis to finite values of the coupling constants. And there is evidence from actually solving for the holomorphic sector of the theory that SL2Z in a slightly modified form really does act upon the chiral fields, and they transform with the appropriate modular weight. In fact, once you add the relevant deformation, what happens is that SL2Z has the effect of permuting the different vacuum states. But the key point is that all the chiral operators in the theory, whose VEVs you can calculate from this superpotential, all transform as modular forms with the appropriate weights that you expect from the N equals 4 theory. So as I have very limited time...
I still have a question.
Sure.
It seems to me SL2Z changes the magnitude of beta.
Changes the magnitude of beta, it does.
So can't I just say that I proved whatever property is small beta, but that's it, and then use the SL2Z simply to argue that actually it's true for any magnitude of beta?
Well, you don't really... You only believe the SL2Z symmetry if the point and its image... Well, based on the linear analysis, you only believe the SL2Z symmetry if both the point and the image are close to the N equals 4 point, right? And in general, that won't be true, right? In fact, as you said, in general, it's not true. So you can't just deduce on the basis of linearized analysis that this will persist for a finite deformation. You can't rely on the properties of the N equals 4 theory. You have to just fall back on what you can calculate in theories with N equals 1 supersymmetry. And that is essentially all you can calculate in these theories is essentially this holomorphic sector of the theory where the condensates of the chiral operators depend holomorphically on various coupling constants. So that was sort of a lightning review. Now I actually want to use this duality for something, which is where S-duality originally came from, why people thought electric-magnetic duality might be a really interesting thing, is that although it's a rather sort of abstract property in the N equals 4 theory, if you can actually apply S-duality in the more physical context of more realistic massive phases, like Higgs and confining phases, then you can actually show that something quite interesting happens. And this goes back to old ideas of Toft and Mandelstam. Basically, the idea goes as following. Well, we would like to understand confinement, and there is at least one situation in which we do understand confinement. However, it's confinement of magnetic objects, magnetic charges, magnetic monopoles, rather than confinement of electric objects. The situation in which we do understand confinement is when you have a theory in its Higgs phase, and the gauge group, in particular, when the gauge group is U1, we understand this very well, is spontaneously broken because a field that carries electric charge condenses in the vacuum. In a Higgs vacuum in which the gauge symmetry has been spontaneously broken, a relativistic analog of the Meissner effect occurs. Magnetic, if you could put a magnetic charge in that medium, because of the Meissner effect, it's not energetically favorable for the magnetic flux lines to spread out. Instead, it's energetically favorable for them to form tubes. And if you put a magnetic charge and a magnetic anti-charge, which you can think of doing as formally, or you can literally do in a non-abelian theory where they're magnetic monopoles, then the energetically preferable configuration is that they're joined together by a magnetic flux tube. And of course, you can realize this all in a rather straightforward way in the non-abelian Higgs model and show that the abelian Higgs model, and show that external magnetic charges are indeed confined. Well, an old idea that goes back to Toft is that we should actually be able to understand the confining phase to some extent as being an electric magnetic dual of this phenomenon. So the idea is that if there is a duality between electric and magnetic charges and fields, then you could think about there being a situation in which there was a dual of the Meissner effect. A situation which is very exotic from the point of view of weakly coupled field theory, where the magnetic charges become light and can condense in the vacuum. And if you do so, just by an inversion of the arguments leading to the Meissner effect, you get a dual Meissner effect in which electric charges are confined by the formulation of electric flux tubes. And so one of the oldest ideas, motivations for thinking about S-duality is that there should be a duality between these two phases. Higgs and confining phases should be dual to each other. And actually, we know a lot of concrete realizations of this idea, most notably the work of Seiberg and Witten. And this SL2Z that I talked about earlier gives you yet another concrete realization of these ideas in this beta-deformed theory, where you take the conformal field theory and further deform it with a relevant operator, because indeed SL2Z does permute the Higgs and confining phases. Although we can't calculate anything other than the vacuum condensates, you can actually use SL2Z to understand the mapping between the Higgs and the confining phases. So we know that in principle this mapping is there, and it has been realized in supersymmetric field theories. For example, you can map a confining vacuum that's continuously related to one of the vacua of N equals 1 Suzy Yang Mills onto a Higgs vacuum. So, in the rest of my time, if I have much time left, what time am I due to finish at? 20 minutes, okay, that's not bad. Okay, I can slow down a little bit. I thought it was shorter than that. So what I want to do is look at the vacuum structure of this relevantly deformed version of N equals 4 Suzy Yang Mills, and actually try and understand in this context what will be quite a new and novel manifestation of this duality between Higgs and confining phases, which I think potentially will teach us something useful about the confining phase and its large end limit. So basically what I want to do now is rewind and go back to think about the classical properties of this so-called beta-deformed, marginally deformed N equals 4 theory. And then at the end of the story, the SL2Z duality transformation will crop back in again. So just to rewind, let's now look at what the classical vacuum states of this theory are. And the way that you do that is solving what are called the F-term vacuum equations that come from stationarizing the superpotential. But basically, you have your three n by n scalar matrices, the three complex scalar VEVs, phi1, phi2, and phi3, and they have to solve equations which say that the deformed commutator of each pair of these fields has to vanish. Now, these equations are rather well studied, and they have the property that in general, that there are only, for general generic values of beta, there are only trivial solutions. In fact, you can only find solutions where only one of these fields is non-zero. You can see that if only one of these fields is non-zero, that's automatically going to be a solution.
So at the beginning, you didn't identify the vacuum locale by doing a linear analysis.
Yes.
So that's how you identify the parameter beta.
Yes.
Now, how you know that the parameter beta corresponds to this
Because, well, let me tell you. I think I should rewind a couple of transparencies earlier. So the evidence for the exact form of S-duality is that you take this, the theory with this superpotential, right, which is specifically this deformed commutator and this parameter kappa, right? Now you have, in fact, the result of Lee and Strassler, which says that in linear order, you can identify that the marginal parameter is beta, but beyond linear order, they actually proved that there is an exact set of fixed points that are formed just from kappa, beta, and the gauge coupling condition. So they showed that if you take the coupled beta functions for these three couplings, beta, kappa, and tau, which I haven't shown here, the coupling constant of the N equals 4 theory, the beta function equations for those three couplings boil down to a single equation, a single complex equation for three unknowns, so that they generically have two parameter families of solutions. Now you find a two parameter family from your linearized analysis, therefore you have the right to assume that that extends globally, as you know that globally the dimensionality of the solution space is two dimensional. So basically, you can say that for some combination of kappa and beta, there will be a new superconformal field theory. So I express that by saying which we can choose which value of beta we like, and the value of kappa is determined in terms of that. And in particular, the value of kappa doesn't enter into the vacuum equations that I'm solving here. So let me try and find the transparency that I was looking at previously. This one. So we're rewinding now to this classical analysis of the vacua, in which we have to solve these deformed commutator equations. And generically, they only have trivial solutions, where one of the fields is non-zero, and then you can diagonalize it by a gauge transformation, and that gives you a vacuum which is very much like you'd find in the N equals 4 theory, a Coulomb branch. However, at finite values of the coupling, you get new possibilities. In particular, it's very well known that if you take finite values of this deformation parameter, these equations, if you take beta over 2 pi to have a rational value, you find new solutions. And the famous solution of these equations involves what are called the clock and shift matrices, the n by n clock and shift matrices. And you can check that if you take matrices where one of them, the diagonal, is nth roots of unity, and the other one is just a permutation matrix, then you can take the scalar fields up to a gauge transformation to have these three values, and the overall normalization of the three values is arbitrary, as these are the equations that you have to solve, and you find a new branch of vacua. So this was known some time ago, that this new branch of vacua existed classically. So recent work by other people has also highlighted some interesting features of the physics on this new branch that you can actually just see purely classically. So now if you take this new branch of vacua, in which the gauge group is actually completely broken, or broken down to the central U1, it's a genuine Higgs branch, and we parameterize it by, let's say, our two complex numbers, alpha 1 and alpha 2, those were just the overall magnitudes of the vacuum expectation value. So my vacuum was like this, where the U is the clock matrix, and V is the shift matrix, and alpha 1 and alpha 2 are arbitrary complex numbers. And for simplicity, I set the third complex number to 0. If you calculate the classical spectrum on this branch, you find a surprise that it has a very interesting interpretation. And all of this is purely classical at the moment. It just involves diagonalizing the mass matrix. You discover that the n squared degrees of freedom in each of these scalar fields organize themselves in quite an interesting way. If you can label those degrees of freedom by two integers, which run from 1 to n, and the mass formula for those scalar fields has the following form. It involves, as you'd expect, the magnitudes of the VEVs, and then depends on these integers through these sign factors. And you find something extra, which is that you find an unexpected degeneracy of states, that in fact, although in general there's only n equals 1 supersymmetry, at this special point, when you calculate the classical spectrum, you find a strange degeneracy of states, which you wouldn't have expected, which is that 8 Bose and 8 Fermi states, basically all the states in the theory with this mass for each value of L1 and L2, are degenerate with each other. So what's the interpretation of this? Well, the interpretation of this is to do with what's called deconstruction in the modern language. That you actually can think about a Kaluza-Klein interpretation for this mass spectrum. And this is clearest in the case where you take the large n limit. If you take the large n limit, then you can replace these sign factors by just linear factors in this L1 and L2, and L1 and L2 are essentially arbitrary integers. And then you discover what you've got is precisely a Kaluza-Klein spectrum. The Kaluza-Klein spectrum, basically, these two integers correspond to momenta in two new directions. They're quantized because these dimensions are compact. And you discover that the spectrum that you see classically is actually precisely the spectrum of a six-dimensional theory compactified on a torus down to 4 dimensions. And you can express the radii of the torus of compactification in terms of the variables which characterize the vacua. So What's more, in fact, this higher dimensional theory actually is a higher dimensional theory with extended supersymmetry. Because you have this seemingly accidental degeneracy, the spectrum actually matches precisely with the classical spectrum of a six-dimensional supersymmetric theory with a much bigger supersymmetry group. In fact, n equals 1, 1 supersymmetry, which is as big as the full n equals 4 supersymmetry algebra in four dimensions. So, of course, this is not quite what we have, because n isn't infinite. In general, we're going to take finite n. And what happens then is that you have to put back, instead of your linear factors, you have to put back your sine factors. But that still has a nice interpretation, because now this is actually precisely the spectrum that you'd expect if you latticize those extra dimensions. So in particular, if you have a Kaluza-Klein momentum, continuous, it's of course quantized, and it's arbitrary, runs over arbitrary integer values, but if you now discretize those dimensions, then the momentum is in fact becomes periodic itself. This is just to do with the fact that it has to live on the dual torus. So in fact, the momentum is combined to, if you like, to a first Brillouin zone, and basically lives in Zn rather than in the full set of integers. It's defined modulo n. And that means that your t squared is replaced, instead of having a continuous torus, you actually have an n by n lattice. And the lattice spacing is also related to the parameters of the theory. And these sine factors are precisely what you would get if you took continuous derivatives and discretized them on this torus on an n by n lattice. And in fact, you precisely have this higher dimensional spectrum. So what does this mean? Well, this is part of a game that people have been playing for a while over the last few years, which is called deconstruction, which wasn't something that I was fully aware of before I worked on this. But it's the fact that actually in certain well-documented circumstances, you can actually take a UN gauge theory and rearrange it to make it look like a gauge theory with a smaller gauge group, but in a higher dimension where the extra degrees of freedom correspond to n squared, in this case, lattice sites, and that you compactify your higher dimensional gauge theory down to four dimensions on an n by n lattice. And in this case, I'm taking a slightly more general rational value of beta, and and I have my six-dimensional theory, which is now non-abelian. This matches the spectrum that I showed on the previous transparencies, and it's compactified down to four dimensions on an n by n lattice. And this is a purely classical phenomenon at the moment, which is known as deconstruction. So in fact, what you can do is not just show that the spectrum agrees with this higher dimensional theory, you can actually rewrite the action for these modes as a lattice gauge theory in higher dimensions. And this is something first done by people like Arkani Hamed and Georgi in the context of orbifold theories, that actually the n squared degrees of freedom in the four-dimensional theory organize themselves as, if you have a divisor of n, into m squared matrices that are m by m, but on a little n by n lattice. And in fact, the action is exactly the action that you would expect, in fact, for a non-commutative lattice gauge theory, where the gauge symmetry is a non-commutative deformation of the gauge symmetry of the ordinary Wilson lattice action. And classically, even classically, this theory has quite a remarkable behavior if you think about its renormalization group flow. It starts out in the ultraviolet as a four-dimensional supersymmetric conformal field theory. As you flow into the infrared, you start to see this tower of modes, at least you do if you're in large N, and the theory is well approximated by continuum six-dimensional theory with a smaller gauge group and more supersymmetry. And finally, when you reach the radius of the torus as a length scale, go down the Kaluza-Klein modes decouple, and you end up with just a four-dimensional theory again, but it's a four-dimensional theory with more supersymmetry. So this phenomenon of deconstruction is actually a way of constructing extra dimensions, constructing higher-dimensional gauge theories that are actually non-renormalizable if you tried to think of them as fundamental theories, but constructing them as effective theories, effective low-energy theories for four-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theories. So in fact, in this case, you have a renormalization group flow that takes you from four dimensions to six dimensions down to four dimensions. So these are observations essentially due to Adams and Fabinger in this context. Now I probably really am running out of time. How much longer have I got? 5 minutes. Okay, I'll try and do something in 5 minutes here and put the different pieces of the story together. So this is a Higgs phase, and the natural thing to look for in a Higgs phase, especially a Higgs phase which might be S-dual to a confining phase, is for this phenomena of confinement of magnetic charges due to the condensation of electric charges. So in general terms, if we have a phase like this classically, we expect to see the formation of flux tubes. In this case, I'm not completely breaking the gauge group, but in fact I'm partially breaking it. So you would just expect to find flux tubes which confine magnetic charges corresponding to the broken generators of the gauge group. In general, in four dimensions, these things are usually extremely hard to find. Even the ordinary Nielsen-Olson vortex, in fact, doesn't have an analytic solution. So they can be very sensitive. In general, they might be topologically stable, as they are in this case, but they're usually not BPS saturated in the supersymmetric sense. It turns out that in this context, you can actually show that these strings have a very, very nice realization, and something that's obvious if you think about this six-dimensional effective theory. If you have a non-abelian gauge theory in six dimensions, there's an obvious way to get strings. The obvious way to get strings is just to take a four-dimensional Yang-Mills instanton, an ordinary instanton solution of a four-dimensional gauge theory, and think about it as a static solution in six dimensions. And that provides for you a string with a variable core size in the higher dimensional theory. And in fact, and this is one of the main results of the paper that's just coming out, you can show that in fact, if you embed an instanton in your low-energy effective theory, it provides a BPS-saturated string. And if you track that back to what it means in terms of the original four-dimensional theory, it is in fact precisely a chromomagnetic flux tube that carries one unit of magnetic flux. So, as I'm rapidly coming towards the end of the story, well, not rapidly enough, but coming towards the end of my time, basically, what I want to just tell you about is the fact that you can use S-duality now to show something quite interesting and novel happens, which you can think about from the lattice perspective. So far, all I've talked about is the weakly coupled lattice theory, and correspondingly, it's a long way away from its continuum limit. The basic dynamical length scale in this six-dimensional theory set by the string tension at weak coupling is much, much smaller as a length scale than the lattice spacing. These are both related to the underlying parameters of the four-dimensional theory in this way. And of course, what all these deconstruction games are about are, can we find a way to think about the continuum limit of this theory? Can we somehow think about what will happen if we go to a regime in which the lattice spacing is much smaller than the dynamical length scales of the theory, and you would expect to define a continuum theory? So of course, there's a catch in doing that. If you look at what regime of parameters you need to take you to the continuum limit, at least naively, it's a regime of parameters in which n is large, but you have to take the coupling constant to be strong. So in fact, you can argue, and most of these deconstruction arguments do argue, that there is, because you have BPS objects, there's a kind of stability property, and that you do, at strong coupling, get light strings and a six-dimensional theory, which has certain special properties. And in general, we don't have many ways of understanding this limit directly. But basically, the only message that I want to finish with is that in this case, you can put the two pieces of the talk that I've introduced together in an interesting new way, and you can actually take this classical Higgs branch, look at this supposed continuum limit, and actually now you can analyze it from the standpoint of the S-duality, which I argued for earlier. As usual, and this is all basically things that I'll just have to state rather than giving you the direct arguments in favor of this, but in usual, as you'd expect, it maps a Higgs phase to a confining phase, and because it's a strong weak duality coupling transformation, it maps the strong coupling of one theory into the weak coupling limits of another theory. And it's a very particular weak coupling limit, as it's a limit in which n is going to infinity and g squared goes to zero, and the continuum limit involves taking the ratio fixed on the left-hand side, you would keep the product of g squared n fixed on the right-hand side. So in fact, what you discover is that this continuum limit has a reinterpretation in terms of something where you would expect light strings to appear. The Toft limit of a gauge theory in its confining phase, where basically the classic arguments of Toff indicate you should be able to understand the glueball spectrum in terms of excitations of strings being the dynamical variable. Now, what I'm working on at the moment, and this paper which is coming out soon will address, is understanding just to what extent we can make this concrete and actually say that we do have light strings and that you can understand these light string theory as being a Toft limit of a confining phase of a gauge theory. But this is the particular application of S-duality which the results I introduced in the first part of the talk have. I'll just flash some conclusions, just remind you what we've talked about very quickly. A marginal deformation of n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills, which exhibits a non-trivial extension of S-duality, and gives us another example, one of many that now exist, of an S-duality between Higgs and confining phases. Part of what's interesting is that you find all kinds of new branches when you deform the theory, in particularly these classical Higgs branches. And these branches exhibit very interesting large N physics involving extra discrete dimensions, extra latticized dimensions, extra supersymmetry, and BPS saturated strings. And I've introduced some speculations about the relationship between S-duality and the continuum limit of this system. And I'd better stop there. You did, yes.
Morita equivalence in the context of associative algebras.
Well, Morita equivalence is also a property of non-commutative field theories on the torus. Field theories on the non-commutative torus. And if I can find the transparency that I want, I can. You can see where you saw Morita equivalence. So this is basically, there's a classical statement that if you have a gauge theory on a non-commutative torus with a rational value of the non-commutivity parameter, there is a Morita dual formulation, a completely equivalent formulation, as a classical theory on the torus with Toft boundary conditions. Okay? And in this case, what you can show is the map between the fields of my low-energy six-dimensional theory that arises via deconstruction and the original four-dimensional theory I started with is precisely the Morita equivalence map between field configurations. Okay? So what that means that you can do is you can show one property that Morita equivalence has that you can prove very rigorously is that on doing this transformation, you map topological charges in one theory in topological into topological charges in the dual theory. And one of the transformations in the Morita equivalence group is that it will take the theory on this torus cross four extra commutative dimensions and identify instanton number, which is second Chern class of the gauge field, will be mapped onto a particular first Chern class, which you can identify as a magnetic flux. So that's why you can make a very precise statement that the instanton strings which appear in the low energy theory are precisely the magnetic flux tubes that you expect in the Higgs phase of this theory. And that's going to be one of the results in the forthcoming paper that should be out soon.